I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon members. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon member of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. You'll see the link in the upper right-hand corner, or you can check out the direct link below in the description. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to go back to 1978 and talk about some of the big professional competitions from 1978. I'm going to read some archived magazines that I have from Muscle and Digest and Muscle Mag International, and also, of course, Muscle Builder Magazine, Joe Weider's official magazine. And we're going to talk about when professional bodybuilding really got started in 1978. With two competitions. Of course, you had the Mr. Olympia that has been going since 1965, but that was really the only professional bodybuilding competition, at least consistently. So then in 1978, Wayne D'Amelio joined the IFBB, and also Ken Sprague was instrumental in getting this going as well. We'll talk about that in a second when we talk about the details of these contests. But Ken Sprague from Gold's Gym was also pretty much instrumental in getting professional bodybuilding going. But Wayne D'Amelio held his first Night of the Champions competition that year in 1978. So I've got some articles that I wanted to talk about that. It was kind of a controversial contest. And then Ken Sprague, only a couple months later in Los Angeles, held the Gold's Classic, which was the World Cup and a bunch of other competitions. So I want to talk about that as well. I've got some several different viewpoints. It's interesting going back over these old magazines and reading different viewpoints of the contest, so you could try to find out the real story of what happened. So that is what we're going to be doing today on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm still trying to get some interviews. I reached out to Frank Richards this week and Phil Hill and also Rick Wayne. So hopefully we'll get something lined up with one or all of these guys pretty soon. Keep working on that for you guys. So we'll see what happens. All right, what else is going on? Springtime is in full bloom out here in Tampa, Florida. We have days now in the 80s, and it's only March, but it's not too warm yet. So I hope it's getting warm wherever you guys are at. I see they're still getting snow in some parts of the country and I'm sure around the world. But springtime is in the air. Hopefully it'll be here soon. I think the beginning of spring is this month, right? Yeah, I think so. So the days are getting longer. Staying light out a little bit longer, so that's really cool. So speaking of summer coming, I have a countdown to the 4th of July, which is only about 3 months away. So this will be on my other website, johnhansenfitness.com. If you guys want to join me, I have a special deal going where I will write up a workout and diet program for anybody who wants to get ready for the summer, a three-month preparation period. It'll start on April 11th. And it will go 3 months until the 4th of July. So on April 11th is a Thursday, and exactly 12 weeks later will be July 4th. So I am starting my diet for the summer, and if you guys want to join me, just go to johnhansenfitness.com. The information should be up in the next week, and you can get a special deal for a three-month training and nutrition consultation to get ready for July 4th, get ready for the summer. The winter was bad for you and you got out of shape. Now is the time to get back in shape and I will help you out. So go to johnhansenfitness.com. Like I said, the information will be up probably within the next week and I will have a special 3 month training and diet nutrition program ready for you guys to help you out. All right. What else is going on? I was at the Gasparilla Film Festival this last weekend out here in Tampa. Of course, you guys know I'm a big movie buff. And they had opening night Thursday night at the Tampa Theater. Cash Out was the movie. It was a John Travolta movie, kind of a heist film. So that was the opening night film at the Tampa Theater. It was absolutely packed. They said it was their biggest night ever. And then, of course, all the weekend, Friday and Saturday and up till Sunday, they were having other movies throughout the Tampa area, not at the Tampa Theater, but throughout the Tampa area I saw a couple last night, one called La Boy, Texas, which was a good film, kind of like a Fargo type film. Pretty entertaining. So that'll be coming out, I think, mainstream next month in April. So look for that film if you guys are into good films. And then there was another one, a Rob Schneider film called Dead Wrong, but it was not a comedy. It was a pretty brutal mob movie. And then I'm going to go see a movie called The Invisibles, which is the closing night film. And that will be tonight at Sunday at the Tampa Theater. So checking out some movies out here in Tampa, Florida, pretty fun. It's always cool when you go to those film festivals because they have the director, sometimes they have the stars, and then they stay afterwards and they answer questions. And then they'll answer questions from the audience, which is really cool. The guy from Dead Wrong, the director, was there last night at the screening, and he said they filmed the whole movie in 17 days, which was amazing to me. It was like a 2.5 hour movie or over 2 hours. Couldn't believe they filmed that thing in a little over 2 weeks. That was crazy. What else? I've got my eBay page going on. I've got the link down below if you guys want to check out. I always get emails from some of you guys asking for any magazines that I have for sale. So I'm putting all my extra magazines that I'm selling and also some books that I'm selling, bodybuilding books. I'm putting them up on my eBay page. So I will put that link below in the description. So check that out. I've got some really good old Iron Man magazines, even some Muscle Builders and Muscular Developments. And I got a couple Muscle Digests, all old stuff, all from the 70s and 80s. So you guys want to check that out if you're into the magazines like I am. Got a big collection, but might as well get rid of some of these extra ones that I've got since there's no sense in having two of them when I can share it with the rest of the world. I just recently sold a book called Mass, which was written by Dennis Weiss and Robert Kennedy. I had a lot of great photos in that, so I sold that at a perfectly new edition. I just had two of them for some reason, so I just sold that. And also that book, Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait, which was written by George Butler. We actually did a show on it on our podcast about a month or two ago. I have an extra one of those, so I'm selling that as well. So yeah, check out the eBay page if you guys are looking for any magazines. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, just send me an email at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, guys. Well, let's get into some of these cool articles about these competitions from 1978. So this first one I want to read comes from Muscle Digest magazine. This is from the October 1978 issue, and it is an article about the Night of the Champions. And it's called The Night of the Champions Turns into the Night of Controversy. It's written by Bob Summer, who was a feature editor for Muscle Digest. So I thought I'd start off with the most controversial article here. It says, as if to erase the memory of his poor 1977 Olympia showing, Robbie Robinson came prepared for 1978's first major professional contest, the Night of the Champions, held in New York's Town Hall on May 6th. And although in the opinion of many, he was still not in top shape, he impressed the judges enough to be chosen first in the eight-man lineup at the IFBB-sanctioned event, officially known as the American Professional Bodybuilding Championships. But the real surprise of the contest was in the placings that came after Robinson, when MC Ricky Wayne, the self-styled bad boy of bodybuilding, who seems to be most at home in the midst of controversy, either real or contrived, announced the judges' final order of place winners. The unbelieving but highly vocal sellout crowd responded with the loudest, most prolonged round of boos and jeers probably ever heard at a physique contest, major or minor, held in this country. Veteran observers of the sport said they had never seen or heard anything like it. The rumble of discontent began to be heard when native New Yorker Dennis Tenorino was called out for sixth place. Much improved over his 1977 Olympia condition and fresh off his win at Chet Yorton's quote, natural Mr. America, unquote, non-steroid users contest, this hometown boy made good, deserved better, many in the audience seemed to feel. After Dennis's sixth place announcement came, a minor riot occurred. Apparently, the New York crowd felt Dennis was a top contender for first place. The crowd's discontent with the sixth place selection, however, paled in its contempt for the next call. Incredibly, the two that many obviously considered the best men in the contest, Boyer Coe and Ed Corney, were called out by Wayne for fourth place, a tie. Fifth place was left unfilled since the promoters had to pay both Coe and Corney the fourth place money, $1,000 each, and apparently had nothing left to pay other place winners. During the prejudging, Coe's improved appearance had been widely remarked on. The added muscularity in his chest and deltoids gave his upper body already outstanding an even more impressive finish and improved shape. Corny, by now everyone's favorite poser and one of the most popular bodybuilders yet developed in America, was obviously the crowd's favorite. Although he came in somewhat heavier and less sharp than he was at last year's Olympia, he was still the best to many of his New York fans. In the individual posing portion of the evening, he had flawlessly gone through his almost legendary posing routine, this time to the accompaniment of Frank Sinatra's My Way, and once more brought his cheering fans to their feet. To them, Corny's way was simply the best way, and they were unwilling to accept the judge's decision. So when third place, Bill Grant, was announced, something approaching pandemonium broke out. Oh, how Ricky Wayne seemed to be enjoying himself. How was it possible, the audience seemed to be saying, for a vascular but markedly flawed and unsymmetrical bodybuilder to be found superior to three of the top physique champions in the world? Some also wondered how a bodybuilder who had been suspended by the IFBB for competing in Serge Nubre's World Amateur Bodybuilding Association's Mr. Universe contest in Paris in November could be competing in New York in May at an IFBB professional contest. Obviously, there was more to this contest than met the eye. The feeling that symmetry was not one of the things that the judges had paid much attention to was confirmed when Roy Callender was called out for second place. Unfortunately, his large thighs throws off his physique off balance and makes his deficient calves appear even smaller. In addition to his selection as runner-up, it was curious that a Canadian born in England could compete and place high in a contest supposedly to find the best American professional bodybuilder. During the day, few, if any, had predicted that the contest would turn out to be this way, but to the perceptive observer, little incidents that unfolded before and during the contest prejudging foreshadowed the stunningly surprised outcome. Things such as one of the judges having breakfast with a couple of the competitors, later named as top place winners, and things such as the jabbing and entirely out of place remarks made by Wayne about one of the competitors' criticisms of things he had written. Also, the makeup of the judging panel raised several questions. Although the judges, Sam Yerrick, Peter Potter, Jim Mannion, Susan Fox, Mike Edwards, and Leroy Colbert, had reportedly been personally approved by the IFBB's top officer, it would be interesting to see how many, if any, qualified as IFBB national judges under the criteria set forth in the current edition of the IFBB official guidebook. It was surprising that a more prestigious group of judges had not been found for a contest promoted as one of the year's top physique events. It was also curious that none of the judges seemed to have been eliminated because of previous or current associations with the individual competitors. Although the widely respected Roger Schwab served as head judge, his was a non-voting position, more similar to that of an expediter. At the end of the contest, it was apparent that he had been as surprised with the results as the audience and most of the competitors had been. After the prejudging, the consensus of feeling seemed to be that the contest would go one of three ways: Coe, Corny, or Robinson, with Robinson perhaps having the slight edge. But only slight, he was not much better than the others. Although they competed in different classes, Coe in the under 200-pound class, Robinson in the over 200-pound class, he watched Coe closely and tried to avoid being placed near him in any lineup where the judges could compare them. Obviously, he felt that Coe was the man to beat in the contest. Nevertheless, the judges did somehow find a way to compare them, much to Robinson's advantage, judging from the scoring. For the record, the final score tallies, as well as the prize money awarded, were as follows. First place went to Robbie Robinson with 284 points and $4,000. Second place, Roy Callender, 269 points and $2,000. Third place, Bill Grant, 266 points, $1,500. Fourth place, Boyer Coe and Ed Corny, they each scored 265 points each, only 1 point behind Bill Grant, for a $1,000 prize for each of them. And then sixth place, Dennis Tenorino, 252 points, way down, for only $750. Joe Nazario and Don Modzelewski, the other two men in the lineup, scored 231 and 230 points, respectively. Promoters Wayne D'Amelia and Charles Blake, as well as Karen, Wayne's ebulliently cheerful wife, obviously put much effort and planning into their arrangements for the contest. Although the lighting was not quite right, such defects will probably not be remembered when people recall the contest. What will probably be remembered is that the first annual American Professional Bodybuilding Championships was a contest where many of the less attractive aspects of the current American bodybuilding scene became strikingly apparent. So what was billed as rather effectively promoted as the Night of the Champions will instead be remembered by many who were there as the Night of Controversy. All right, so let's go to Muscle Builder's report of the contest. And this was written by Rick Wayne, who, as they just mentioned, was the MC for the competition. So this comes from the August 1978 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. It says, the Night of the Champions was Robbie Robinson Day at last. Oh, Cape Crusader, where were you and the Boy Wonder when I needed you? We could tell by the number of times Wayne D'Amelio called from New York that he was not exactly the coolest cat in all of Gotham City. First, he wanted to know, and this was back in January, if there was enough time to get his advertisement into Muscle Builder. We assured him we'd carry it in three consecutive issues of the magazine. Then he called to say, hold everything. He and his partner, Charles Blake, had decided to make up their own ad and would have the whole camera-ready thing to us in a matter of days. 3 days after that call, Wayne was on the phone again, this time to inquire whether or not his artwork had arrived safely and did it meet our demanding requirements. We answered yes on both counts. But then there was another call from New York. Hold everything, Wayne said this time. Charles had apparently come up with a dynamite idea. In Gotham City, most things are dynamite or dynamic, as in the dynamic duo, that would make everything before it appear primitive. Yes, that's what he said, primitive. So we waited. 2 days went by without a call from Wayne D'Amelio. But now we were hearing from Ben Weider himself. It seems D'Amelio had, for whatever reason, decided to deal directly with the president of the IFBB. And the prez was on the phone to ask us to be sure Wayne D'Amelio's contest ad appears in the next issue of the magazine, as if there was any chance we'd be allowed to forget. Wayne's ad was beautiful. Hey, it was probably set a standard for other contest promoters, and I'm going to stick my scarred neck out and say it is the best bit of artwork we've had from anyone outside our office. Not even Ken Sprague's World Cup ad comes close, a situation which Charles Blake, an artist, as it turns out, must take full credit. I know a number of guys, hardened muscle guys, let me tell you, who have the D'Amelio show poster all framed and hanging on their bedroom walls. Cacun Asun Gout, as they say on the left bank of Gay Paris. Better I should write Happy Paris to be safe. You never know these days. And in the nicer areas of Montreal, too, I gather. Well, we kept our word. Wayne D'Amelio's specially prepared advertisement appeared in three consecutive issues of Muscle Builder. And from the first insert, the money started rolling in. Before long, Wayne was actually laughing on the phone. Oh, yes, he still called every 3 days or so, out of habit, I presume, suggesting he just might offer more cash prizes than even the Mr. Olympia promoters had so far come up with. And then, with 1 month to go before May 6th, the old Wayne started calling all over again. Honest, you could practically hear him biting his toenails. He was that nervous. Have you heard anything out there in California? He'd ask. Like what? Oh, like who's entering my Night of the Champions? And we tell him big fat lies. We say, oh, last we heard, Waller and Lou and Sergio and everybody was itching to show up on the big night. One time he called up to say he was very worried that Bill Grant had gone and got himself banned after I told everyone he was going to be there. Wayne told us he had a cold and that was why he was sniffling as he spoke. But so help me, it sounded like he was crying salt water into the receiver. So we told him we felt certain Bill would do the necessary and would likely be reinstated by the time the big night arrived. As things turned out, we were right. Bill apologized for whatever misdemeanor he had committed and his sin slate had been wiped clean. Then it was Danny Padilla who was causing poor Wayne to lose sleep. I don't understand those guys, said the Virgin promoter. They tell you they'll be there and you go ahead and start pushing the word, but when you have nearly all your tickets sold, you start hearing funny stories. Now Danny says he ain't sure he's going to be able to make it, and Steve Mihalik tells me his kneecaps are dead, and some people tell me even Robbie Robinson won't be there. Another time Wayne assured us everyone in New York knew Robbie had died. So why don't you guys level with me, the way he said it? Had Robbie really died? Just then Wayne would have considered the death all part and parcel of a plot to sink his Night of the Champions. We reassured him, after all, one had interviewed the Black Prince mere minutes before Wayne's desperate call. At last, he had reason to be jubilant. 95% of the tickets had been gobbled up by muscle fans everywhere from just his three ads appearing in Muscle Builder magazine. Most of the champs had promised solemnly to be on call. The $4,000 first prize money had proved irresistible. Ah, but now, as if you hadn't guessed, there was another problem. Wayne had arranged for television appearances at Gotham City gyms, newspaper interviews, and so on, and he wasn't sure the contenders for his Night of the Champions title would want to break training in order to be on call in New York a few days before the contest. I promised I'd be happy to make the television dates and the radio spots, too. If push came to shove, I assured him I'd be more than willing to say a few words to the various New York scribes that he mentioned. I must confess at this point that what I had in mind had less to do with the Night of the Champions than the promotion of my most recent book, The Body Men. Ah, but why quibble over trifles, huh? The week before the contest, I received a one-way ticket. As things turned out, I think my services were more than abused, but even the hardened among us must learn from new experiences. So never mind that D'Amelio's promotion cost me money from Physique Productions, and soon afterwards, I boarded an American Airlines jet for New York. Well, I'm not one to talk too heavily about things psychic or supernatural. No, sir. I pride myself on being a realist. A pity. For had things been different, I might have read the signals to my advantage. First, there was that in-flight movie, one that I had avoided like the plague, resisted strongly in spite of all the super hype put out by its makers. I'm talking about Saturday Night Fever, folks. I boarded my plane hoping like hell there was going to be a movie show, hoping it might be something like Fist or the Elvis Presley story. Has that been made yet? The opening of Misty Beethoven, even. But no, what they offered was the precise thing I'd sworn I would not pay money to see. Well, now it was about to be force-fed to me. Whether I liked it or not, I would see Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta. Now, I know the smart Alex among my readers will suggest that I did not have to purchase the headset that the curvy air stewardess offered me soon after takeoff, and they may well have a point, but if there's one thing worse than watching John Travolta perform on the screen, it has to be watching John Travolta do whatever he does in silent movie style. So I suffered. I watched the movie, and I forgot to read the signs. Wayne D'Amelio was at Kennedy Airport awaiting my arrival. So was his wife, Karen. They had both shed pounds, which was not exactly the worst thing in the world for the lady, but altogether a different story for her husband. Let's face it, those of us who know the D'Amelios will know also that Wayne will never compete in the heavyweight division of anything. Meaty, the guy simply is not. And he had grown a beard. Not exactly true. He told me he merely forgot to shave for about 8 weeks. Now, the reason I mention all of this is so you fellows reading me might know that it's not the easiest thing in the world being a muscle show promoter. It can play havoc with your nerves, your eating habits, your sleep, and your wife, too, apparently. Wayne drove me to his house where I had been promised I would stay in luxury, as I had been accustomed to all my life. I tried not to get into the topic of the Night of the Champions for obvious reasons. An hour before hitting the sack, so I have learned from bitter experience, is no time to be going on about horror stories. Well, there we were in Karen's kitchen, sipping tea sweetened with very, very white sugar. So much for the eating habits of top bodybuilders, meaning Wayne and not yours truly. When D'Amelio tells me that one of the reasons he wanted me in town ahead of the contest was to talk to some of the guys who were still hemming and hawing about competing on the big night. The way Wayne spelled it out, Robbie was definitely going to be there. So was Boyer Coe. So was Ed Corney. Dennis Tinerina was one of the not-so-certain cases, as was Don Modzelewski. Why do some people make it difficult for writers by taking such weird names? And Steve Mihalik, too. Padilla would not compete, but had promised to be on stage to say hello and maybe apologize on behalf of his busted knees. So I began with the stranger with the strange-sounding name. Hiya, Don, I said when D'Amelio passed me the receiver. What's this I hear about you not competing next Saturday? By the way, I want to apologize for what Jack Neary did to you the other day. You know, how he misspelled your name and then he put someone else's picture over the aberration. Well, don't feel bad. Jack can't spell and he wears bifocals over his contact lenses. Besides, I said, there was a time when people spelled Schwarzenegger with a T, somewhat in the middle of the name. After your appearance in the Night of the Champions, not even Neary will fail to spell your name right. I hear you're looking, well, dynamite. I have to admit, dear reader, that the balls up over what's-his-name was not Jack Neary's. No, and may Jack find it in his red hair to forgive me for what I told you who. The fault with the misspelled name was mine. I had gone all the way to New York to report on Tom Minicello's IFBB Mr. USA contest and I failed to recall exactly who was the guy with the magnified arms. Then the time had come to caption the picture, and, well, you know the rest. Indeed, from what Wayne told me before, he put his call through to the Mozalewski's residence somewhat after 1 o'clock in the morning on the remembered day. The gentleman had not been amused. He had actually promised to sue Muscle Builder and all concerned with the error referred to earlier. But time had cured him of whatever ailed him, and now there he was on the telephone taking my call. "Well," said Mozalewski at 1:30 a.m., "it's not that I don't want to compete, but man, there's going to be a lot of, wait for it, dynamite guys out there. I hear Robbie's dynamite, right? And what about Bill Grant?" "Hey," I said under D'Amelio's nervous gaze, "winning isn't the point. It's who you lose against that matters. I mean, losing against Robinson can't be nearly as bad as winning against Fat Albert." "Fat who? See what I mean?" Well, it took a half hour of talk on anabolic steroids and a number of promises I might not be able to keep, but finally, Don Mozalewski agreed to be among the champions on D'Amelio's big night. I put the receiver to sleep and was all set to follow when D'Amelio put his skinny foot where it does not belong and spoiled everything. For no reason that I can recall, Wayne started talking about the history of his house. All at once, he was telling me that he and Karen had gone out of their way to make me feel comfortable, had put in new furniture, hung up muscle pictures, moved Wayne's and her trophies, they are softball champions and addicts to boot, from their living room into my bedroom as to create the right kind of atmosphere, as if I keep my Mr. World, Mr. America, Free Mr. Universe class trophies under my pillow at home. And then he said, "The guy who owned this house shot himself, you know." "Fine, fine," I said. "Now I think I'll go on to sleep. It's been a long day." But no, Wayne insisted, "they found him with a bullet in his head." "Okay," I said desperately, not wanting to hear what I knew was the rest of the story. "Yeah, the poor bastard shot himself, committed suicide." "Wayne," I said, "I'm deadly serious. I can't take ghost stories. It's a thing with me. They drive me nuts. I don't sleep for days after I've heard supernatural stories. Even the Munsters makes me too nervous to close my eyes in the dark." "Come on," he says, "the guy didn't shoot himself in your room. He killed himself just outside, right under your bedroom window. Is where they found him with half his head missing." "Okay," I said, "that does it. I'm through. I'm getting out of here." And I probably would have done just that, except it meant I'd have to go outside and find myself a taxi to the airport. And then nobody would believe that I hadn't let a promoter down for no reason at all. So I thought the matter over and then said goodnight to the D'Amelios. Needless to say, I slept very little that night. Even the sound of Long Island's police sirens came to me like screams from Frankenstein movies. I stayed up half the night, halfway between slumber and complete awareness. And with every jump of my overactive heart, I cursed D'Amelio. "May all his tickets be returned," I mumbled to the gods of retribution. I moved out the next day for reasons that I chose not to discuss here, on account of them being somewhat personal and nothing at all to do with D'Amelio's suggestion that I enjoy spaghetti and butter for lunch every day. The day before the contest, as previously arranged, I turned up at 205 East 67th Street to take part in the Bill Boggs Show, Midday Live, I believe. Joe Nazario was already there, resplendent in blue overalls and specially designed white shirt, and what a load of muscle he seemed to be carrying under all of that. We had just met before, just to say hello, and I'd seen him strut his stuff on more than one occasion. Now he was telling me how he just returned from an appearance in Florida that did a whole lot for his self-confidence. "I met Larry Scott," said Nazario. "What a credit to our sport. With guys like that among us, the time must come when bodybuilding will get the respect that it deserves." "And talking of respect," said Nazario, "do you know what these people have in mind for us today?" I said, "No, I didn't have a clue. But I suppose it'd been all arranged by the show's producer and the promoters of the Night of the Champions." Not so, as it turned out, when we met Charlie Blake in the green room. First, he told us Wayne D'Amelio would not be appearing with us, neither would Robbie Robinson. And suddenly I had the scent of rat in my nostrils. "Why not?" I said, echoing Joe Nazario. "I'm not certain," said Blake, "but I'll find out as soon as this is over." "What are we going to do?" Nazario wanted to know, between sips of unsweetened black coffee. "I hope Boggs isn't planning on making fools of us." Just then, a spaghetti stick dressed in leather came into the green room. "Who is Wayne D'Amelio?" he asked, sounding like a whittled down Truman Capote. "Who are the muscle guys? I should have said bodybuilders, right?" Nazario stood up and Spaghetti grabbed his shoulder. "Well, it's like this," he said. "I am the producer's assistant and I want to cue you guys up. There's been some changes, more people on the show than we planned. He went on for a while about a Miss New York State winner who would be appearing on Midday Live, and also a group who were discussing whether or not the law was fair to ladies who murdered their husbands, not to mention the author of a book on gigolos, who apparently had spent over 5 years researching the subject. Yeah, said Nazario, so what do you want us to do? I ain't going to be doing no posing and stuff like that. I thought we were coming here to talk with the show's host. Otherwise, Joe might have showed up in posing trunks. For a while, Charles Blake was telling us the show was already a sold-out affair, and we didn't have to go on if we felt we were going to be given a bad time by Box. Then Ben Weider arrived, beaming. Whatever he'd been doing in town since the day before must have turned out well. We shook hands, he said words to Blake, praised him for the marvelous work he and the new breed of show organizers were doing for the IFBB. At last, we were ushered into what looked like 100 other folk into a studio, where already the host was warming up his audience with his version of Hollywood humor. Shortly after the red light came on, Boggs came over to where Ben, Blake, Nazario, and I were sitting to let us know that he was sorry he didn't have as much time he'd hoped for, but never mind, it'll all work out. Again, Nazario suggested calling the whole thing off. Blake didn't care one way or another. There were no tickets left over anyway, and not appearing wouldn't hurt the box office. Ben said television exposure would help the sport generally. As far as I was concerned, I felt we should do the show. Again, my brain was ticking up yet another opportunity to plug the body men and take our chances with Boggs. As things worked out, Miss New York State went on first. She talked about exercise with the show's host, demonstrated a few exercises, and then Boggs came over to the audience to pick a couple of people at random to take a little workout with the lady in the exercise suit. Naturally, he picked Nazario and yours truly. We joined the attractive lady on the exercise mat, joked around a little, and then Boggs suggested I remove my shirt. A beautiful opportunity to say Nazario was scheduled to show his thing in the IFBB's Night of the Champions a night later and was in far better shape than I, which turned the cameras on Joe. With a little bit of persuasion, he stripped down and, to my surprise, revealed striped posing trunks. I had to admit he looked better than ever, even though he never actually hit any poses, which was fine. The television people loved it. And then Ben came on for a few minutes to say that he was the president of the IFBB and what we were up to. By all accounts, our little group did everyone concerned with bodybuilding proud. And so we come to the morning of May 6th. The town hall was already full when we arrived at 11 a.m. From all over New York, the fans came to witness the prejudging of the Night of the Champions at a fee, of course. In the dressing room, I saw the new Robbie Robinson. 2 weeks earlier, back in California, I had interviewed him for this magazine. He looked huge then. Too large, perhaps, and I wondered if the Night of the Champions would confirm what his detractors often say about him, that Robinson is never in shape on the day of the contest. Days earlier, Robbie had posed at some show or other in San Francisco, and while reports indicated he looked better than he did at the 77 Olympia, many felt he was still puffy and overweight. Well, now he looks small. Well, small by Robinson standards. I guess right then that he weighed between 210 and 215. His face was lean with a hungry look in his eyes, as if he had not had a good breakfast in days and was just about ready to start chomping on the nearest pectoralis major. I recall that only the night before, someone who cared had phoned to ask if I'd set eyes on Robbie and how he shaped up. When I said I had not seen the man, this person said sadly that he'd been told Robinson is all smooth again and right out of shape. What's the matter with that guy? He could be the greatest if... Robbie wore an orange sweatsuit. His hair was still pretty thick, but somehow he had styled it so that it sat neatly about his head without detracting from his shoulder width. When asked how he felt, he stepped forward and without a word grabbed my hand, squeezed it. I got the message. Robbie felt right on. And then Roy Callender walked in. I had not seen eyes on him since, God, was it back in 1969? As long ago as that? We both lived in England then, and he talked of going back to his native Barbados. Ah, now I remember. We last met in Grenada in the Caribbean at some IFBB promotion that was won by Darcy Beckles. Since then, Roy had become a citizen of Canada, had done some very successful wrestling, made a bodybuilding comeback that shook the world. Damn. There were hordes who thought he should have stopped the incredible Makawe dead in his tracks when they encountered each other in the last IFBB Mr. International in Columbus, Ohio. From there, Roy made even further improvement under the guidance of Jimmy Caruso, yes, the photographer, so much so that he completely destroyed fellow Barbadian Darcy Beckles in Nîmes last November. So now Roy was in New York to take on Robbie Robinson and Boyer Coe and Ed Corney and Bill Grant and, yes, Dennis Tenorino. Don Mazzaluski and Joe Nazario would also offer him resistance. It seemed to me that at the prejudging that Robbie Robinson outclassed everyone. If you can conceive of the overall lineup as a tray of expensive jewelry, then see Robinson as the Cartier diamond among them. That's how good he looked. He had not lost size per se. The arms and deltoids, the back, all still were thick and monstrous, but now there were lines, deep lines, separating the various muscle groups, and each muscle was rich with championship striations. The thighs had lost some of their massiveness, but in the process had acquired a new symmetrical look. Hey, believe it, that reminded me of Frank Zane at his very best. Only Robbie was far larger and more defined than I had ever seen Frank. He posed with all the confidence of a super champion. He was having fun. That you can tell when he brought out the ripped up intercostals even in his double bicep shot. His calves had improved to a conspicuous degree, and the biceps, the leg biceps that is, while they were not nearly as huge as before, nevertheless took your breath away when Robbie showed his chest from the side. And talking of Robbie's side chest pose, let me say that it is all muscle, not as in the case of those champions whose side chest shots amount to just a load of rib cage. No, Robbie's chest from the side shows thick serratus magnus, dense and striated pectorals, unbelievable deltoids that are complemented by some of the greatest biceps and triceps in bodybuilding today. Robbie had arrived. At last, Frank Zane, by defeating him last year, had brought Robbie face-to-face with ugly reality. And the Robbie who stood up there, the Black Prince of bodybuilding, was the result. The nightmare result that is destined to haunt Frank Zane's predictable dreams for a long time after the 1978 Olympia. For let it be said here, on the night of the champions, Robbie Robinson appeared invincible. From where I stood, Boyer Coe looked smooth. The improvement in his abdominals that was in evidence last year had somehow disappeared. And while his legs remain unsurpassed, particularly his calves, his back lacked depth and definition. In short, Boyer seemed unprepared for a battle on this night of the champions. On a night that had attracted Robinson and Callender, Coe's arms seemed out of place. Callender was massive. Not even Sergio Oliva at his best showed such thickness of chest, arms, shoulders, and back. Everywhere he looked, Bray shoved muscle in your face, but still he appeared 5 weeks off target. His intercostals were not nearly as defined in Robbie's, and his abdominals still hid beneath a thin layer of excess fat. On any other day, he might have made his way to the front in the shape that he displayed on May 6th, but not with the new Robinson in the show, too. Callender's legs have always been his worst feature. The thighs are thickly muscled, but something about their shape leaves much to be desired. With more cuts, perhaps judges will overlook the flaw. I don't know. Bow legs also add to Roy's misfortunes, accentuating whatever lack there is in his calves. But he made it past the formidable Beckles in Nimes last November. Who's to say he'll not right the wrongs in time to stop Robinson at the Sprague show in July? I hesitate to criticize Ed Corney, possibly the most affable champion in bodybuilding today, certainly the most popular. Corney's posing is beautiful. Every time you see it, it's dramatic. But after the first time, I stopped concentrating on the wrapping and delved deeper into the muscle of the matter. I have to report that while Ed's arms were great on the night of the champions, there was much loose skin in evidence over the rest of his physique. His thighs were not nearly as cut as they have been, and his back, when he did his twisting poses, exposed thick rolls in the lumbar region. It's fair to say that Corney, great as he looked, was not in his best shape, and everyone who figured on stopping Robbie on this night of the champions would have to have been the greatest condition of his career, and then some. Grant was not at his best either. The faults that were his undoing in three Mr. Olympia attempts were still on display on May 6th. Besides, Bill appeared pale, as if he'd not been in the California sun in years. His presentation was not nearly bubbling with confidence. His thighs had been much, much sharper. Likewise, his abdominals. If Bill is to amount to anything more than he already achieved, he'll have to show up better than what we've come to expect of him. Not a trifle worse. Surprise, surprise, I had Dennis Tenorino in second place. Next to Robbie Robinson, he looked as good as I remembered him at his best, when he dazzled blasé London with his mass and muscularity and Italian good looks. His deltoids demanded attention, and his abdominals were sharp. His calves looked really worked out. His posing could do a little more work, however. Mazzaluski and Nazario, although vastly improved, were plain and simply outclassed. Enough said in fairness to both. We will not go into the night's matter. As I've already written about the results in the Night of the Champions, Robbie proved a clear and popular winner. Callender came in second and Grant third. Coe and Corny tied for fourth, and sixth place went to a visibly disappointed Dennis. The Tinnerino family made quite a fuss in the aisles when the results were being announced, which was the only start of a lot of trouble that escalated as the announcement was heard over the speakers. So now a word about the show. It was a mistake on the part of the promoters to have a bar at the theater. When you stage an excitement-packed event like a physique contest, you are asking for trouble if you also make alcoholic beverages available. That is obvious. Then there was a matter of the judges, which Ben Weider is currently investigating and I will no doubt comment on later. As far as I know, Leroy Culbert was the only well-known judge at the event. He and Roger Schwab, who was the head judge, I had never heard of the other people except for Jim Mannion, who sat in judgment on the Night of the Champions. I might add that Culbert was disappointed with most of the results on May 6th, and he was a judge. Charles Blake and Wayne D'Amelio put much effort into their promotion, and all in all, it turned out a good Night of the Champions. A few mistakes were made along the way, but this was their first promotion. Their next will benefit from the experience of May 6th. Certainly, Wayne and Blake will not repeat the mistake of having to depend on these six or eight competitors who promised to make their contest the future. One or two might have fallen sick at the last moment, as indeed happened when Ron Tufel could not appear thanks to an attack of the flu. Had Robinson or Coe found reason not to make the Night of the Champions, the result might well have been catastrophic. Wayne presented a slideshow that was far from perfect. It is this observer's view that he should have booked a couple of variety acts. And what's wrong with the show involving beautiful girls who train regularly with weights? The Night of the Champions might have offered some female champs in the beauty stakes. We would all have enjoyed that. And the show might have gone on a few minutes longer. It's my view that the female population of our somewhat esoteric world has been ignored for far, far too long anyway. But as I've said, in the end, the Night of the Champions was fun for many, even those among the audience who heckled. And Blake and D'Amelio have nothing to be ashamed of. I have seen far worse shows that were put out by so-called experienced promoters. And the winners of the various titles received nothing more than a few cheap trophies. As it was, Robbie went home with $4,000 and a load of renewed self-confidence. The other champs didn't do too badly either. Come to that. All right. It was Rick Wayne's very long article on the Night of the Champions. Unfortunately, he didn't talk a lot about the contest. He just talked about the events leading up to the contest. All right. I've got one more in the Night of the Champions. This one was written by John Balick, and this was written for Muscle Mag International, their annual issue. It says, the Night of the Champions, May 6, 1978, New York, New York. Professional bodybuilding is finally becoming a reality. 2 years ago in Montreal, Arnold created a professional committee. The idea was to have a series of competitions all over the world, such as a Grand Prix auto racing. Wayne D'Amelio is one of the participants at the meeting. Wayne, the editor of North American Bodybuilder, has been an enthusiastic supporter of bodybuilding over the years. The new professional tour gave Wayne the opportunity to put many of his professional and theatrical ideas to work in this, the first of three professional competitions to be held in 1978. The other two being Ken Sprague's World Cup in July and Arnold's Mr. Olympia in September. The production of the Night of the Champions started with the team of Wayne and Karen D'Amelio, plus media expert Charles Blake. The basic idea was to produce a competition that was first class in everything, from the hotel, the Algonquin, the competitions, the presentation, and the prize money. Overall, the complicated process of creating and producing a successful show was admirably executed. Not perfect, but the nits will be picked later in the article. Prejudging got underway about 11 a.m. with the under 200-pound class. Of the top rank of professional bodybuilding, only two competitors were not in attendance. Dan Padilla, a knee injury, and Frank Zane, who will train for the Olympia only. But the judges still had plenty to ponder, as the quality was still here. Boyer Coe, Ed Corny, Bill Grant, and Don Mazaluski. Roger Schwab was the head judge, non-voting, and acted as an expediter choreographer for both classes. Because the judging is divided into three rounds by IFBB rules, mandatory relaxed, mandatory posing, and then free posing, Roger's job was key to a smoothly run pre-judging. He did it as well as I've ever seen, and that includes the legendary Oscar State. As Boyer, Bill, Ed, and Don went through the mandatory rounds, one was struck by a dissimilarity in this group. Each man a champion, yet each a unique projection of genetic potentials. A new look to Boyer, a little smaller at 193. He was 199 at the Olympia, but with better proportions. A very personal posing routine that exemplifies the complete look of power that his physique radiates. Great legs, arm, and back, and even his abdominals improved over the Olympia. Bill Grant, big, muscular, and his much maligned calves improved. Not his casual posing spark and smile, but very serious, like he was a very important job to do. Ed Corney, a man whose physique and enthusiasm for bodybuilding have no age limit. Ed is looking thicker and rounder, if perhaps not as cut as the Olympia. Of the group, he was the strongest poser. He must be seen to grasp the impact of a piece of living sculpture can create, and the best proportioned. Don Mazaluski has some magnificent parts, arms and delts, but they need refinement if he is to achieve the potential that he possesses. If I were he, I would not work my arms directly at all because they now disrupt the symmetry in his person and his physique. Symmetry is usually foremost in a judge's mind. Over 200 pounds, the judges had an easier job with the new Robbie Robinson, maybe 10 pounds lighter than the Olympia. No more puff, no more dominant thighs, just an ultra-muscular symmetrical physique. The apparent juggling of proportions is a lesson to all those would-be competitors. The body must be greater than the sum of its parts. Oh, wow. Big disproportionate is not, oh, wow. Winner. Robbie has been criticized for a posing routine that was less than his physique, but this night he put the stigma to rest with an original, personal, joyful posing routine. The confident, happy person Robbie is was finally brought out for all of us to enjoy. Steve Mihalik has been plagued by injury and accident over the last couple of years. I know that most of his audience were looking forward to seeing this former Mr. America with such great potential. Less than a month before the contest, he severely pulled a calf muscle and was unable to train with the intensity that he knew it would take to win. We all hope to see him in the other two professional contests this year. Roy Callender from Montreal, Canada, made a welcome late entry into this group of heavyweights. Roy is the 1977 world middleweight champion, but this night he was a big 222. Dense, thick slabs of muscle everywhere. His coach, confident Jimmy Caruso, world-famous physique photographer and gym owner, said that he was actually training for two other shows when 2 weeks before they were cajoled into entering by Wayne D'Amelia. Roy may not have been as cut-up muscular as he would have liked because of the short notice, but look out, everybody, when he actually peaks for the next competition. He is a good poser, getting better under Caruso's tutelage, and he has the ability to do battle with anyone. Joe Nazario is very deceptive because of his excellent proportions. He looks lighter than the 200-plus pounds he weighs. Very muscular, but because of the combination of very bright stage lighting, a nitpick, and no tan, he appeared like a white halo on stage. He has a lot of potential to pack on the additional size he'll need to compete in this league. He has several unique poses, but he would do well to work on his presentation, which really is not up to the quality of his physique. Dennis Tinarino, former Mr. America and recent winner of Chet Yorton's Mr. Natural Bodybuilding Contest in Las Vegas, had improved substantially since I last saw him at the Olympia in October 1977. This New York crowd was very partial to this former Easterner. The problem with any show of this quality is that someone has to lose. Where do you draw your line? What type of physique do you prefer? Seven judges had a tough job to place these magnificent competitors. Unfortunately, MC Rick Wayne thought he was Don Rickles that night, and he amplified the judging problem by his ill-conceived remarks. That's another of my nitpicks. Under 200 pounds, Grant, Corney, and Co., 1 point total between them, with Co. and Corney tied. Over 200, Robinson, a clear winner, Callender, and Tinarino. The top six overall were Robinson, Callender, Grant, Corney, and Co., tie, Tinarino. Remember, Grant, Corney, Co., 1 point total spread on 300 possible points. The audience went crazy. Why Grant? Why not Co.? Why not Corney, et cetera, et cetera? The point is, the contest was a toss-up after Robinson and Callender. Controversy was created. This supposedly knowledgeable crowd should know better. It was less than happy ending to an otherwise very well-run show. Several theatrical ideas were used in the evening show, a very effective slide presentation preceding each man live on the stage, a strobe light fog sequence, which was interesting but was marred by people trying to take flash photos. Would you believe? People tried to take flash photos of the slides on the screen. A suggestion, only designated photographers are allowed to shoot. No cameras, the battalion of Insomatics disrupt the show. That is it. The rest of it is all pictures. All right, let's talk about the other pro show of this year, 1978, not the Mr. Olympia, but the World Cup, or the Gold's Classic, as they called it. This was promoted in Los Angeles, I believe at the Shrine Auditorium, by Ken Sprague, who owned Gold's Gym at the time and was becoming a very influential figure in bodybuilding. So there was another controversial article about this contest that was from Muscle Digest. This was the December 1978 issue. I don't know who the author is. Let me see if I can find the author here. No, no author. So it's kind of short, but after this, I want to read Rick Wayne's take on it from a Muscle Builder. So it says, the glittering sign on the backdrop announced the Gold's Classic. To be contested were the titles of Professional World Cup, the Team Challenge of the United States versus the world competitors, the Over 40 Mr. America, and the Teenage Mr. America. It was a very exciting bill, and the auditorium was filled with a good-sized crowd. For the first time, we were to have video screens to provide views of the rear and side of each athlete. Although only one screen was realized, it remains a promotional first for Ken Sprague. In addition, we were able to see many of the internationally known physiques for the first time on the West Coast. There was a live orchestra as well as a three-piece rock band. Even if the music was not always appropriate, it was another promotional innovation. As good as these things were, however, fans were somewhat disappointed when a large number of men advertised for the competition failed to show. Some people paid as much as $50 for their seats, and so it would appear that they would have a legitimate gripe. Frank Zane, Casey Viator, Lou Ferrigno, Ken Waller, Ed Corney, Cal Scalak, Roger Callard, and the USSR's Olive Annis were promised in advertising in the June 1978 issue of Muscle Builder magazine, page 42. Their absence brought many complaints from those who paid to see them. On the other side of the coin, we did get to see Renato Bertagna, Muhammad Makawe, Alois Peck, Peter Stock, and Darcy Beckles. The Professional World Cup was won by a deserving Robbie Robinson. Many in the crowd also supported Roy Callender, however. During the pose down, these two men really went at it. Padilla, the giant killer, during the final pose down, knocked off Callender to gain the overall second position. I thought that Pete Gronkowski had markedly improved from the last time that I saw him, and with a little less body fluid, could have been right up there. The USA versus the world competition was a runaway for the US. Since many top flight men from other parts of the world weren't present, we should not be misled by the results. Bodybuilding is gaining popularity, and soon we will not see this type of lopsided victory. As a matter of fact, if this competition had been held in Europe, the results might have been somewhat different. The Over 40 Mr. America was a very good chance to see that old bodybuilders don't die. They don't even lose their pump. In fact, some of these men were excellent. Notably, Chris Ford, Don Peters, and the eventual winner, Earl Menard, all looked very fit and healthy. It's really in the teenage position of this meet that things got sticky. There's a rumor that's increasing in strength. The winner of the Teenage Mr. America, Rudolfo Aguiano Hermosillo, may not have been a teenager. There's evidence that Rudy entered a contest in January of 1977. On his entry form, he stated that he was 19 years of age. If this is true, then he could not possibly have been anything but 20 in July of 1978. Chet Yorton of Las Vegas may suggest that a search of the public records in Mexico will uncover the truth. For now, it seems that Hermosillo is claiming that he is Puerto Rican rather than Mexican descent. Only time will resolve this issue. But it would be a sad thing if this case that Rudy lied in order to win this award, it could possibly result in his permanent removal as an athlete from the AAU. And that is it. That was a contest where Rudy was, at the time, Sylvester Stallone's bodyguard, and Sylvester Stallone showed up in a white fancy suit to present the award to Rudy. I did not know that. I did not know that he may not have been a teenager. All right, so in the Professional World Cup contest, Robbie won with a score of 296, almost a perfect 300 score. Roy Callender is listed in 283 in second place, and Danny Padilla was 280 in third place. Pete Gronkowski got 265 in fourth place. Boyer Coe, 257 in fifth place. Bill Grant, 255 in sixth place. And then last was Mohamed Makawe from Egypt, who was 251 for seventh place. And then in the pose down, they marked Robbie first, Danny second, and Roy Callender third. So Danny pulled ahead of Roy, even though he was outscored by him in the prejudging during the final round when the judges switched from a point system to a placement system. And where have we seen that before? We saw that the year before at the 1977 Mr. Universe when Cal Skalak beat Mike Mentzer when they used the placement system and not the point system. Judges were Jacques Blumhardt from Belgium, Albert Busack from Germany, Roger Schwab from the USA, Jim Mannion from the USA, Ralph Countryman from the USA, Pat Neve from the USA, and Bill Pearl from the USA. So some great judges. Okay, so let me read this other article by Rick Wayne. This one is, of course, a little bit longer. So we'll hear what Rick has to say about the World Cup. It says, you could tell from the early moments that Danny Padilla planned to grind Egypt's McAway into the floorboards. The Black Prince had never been more prepared for war. Roy Callender had everything but his confidence had deserted him. Grimko had made incredible improvement. It would be a memorable night for some. Others would be doomed to end up tails. When it comes to publicizing an event, there are very few in bodybuilding to equal the expertise of Ken Sprague. Even my typewriter repairman, a guy who's never heard of Farrah Fawcett Majors, let me tell you, was hip to the July 29th IFBB AAU Golds Classic. Are you going to be competing next Saturday? He asked, the day I came around to collect my 2 weeks overdue Remington manual. That's funny, a typewriter repairman. Competing where, I said, muscles and trophies being the furthest thing from my mind just then. The Golds Classic, of course, he said, as if he could tell the difference between your regular supermarket apple and the lump in your throat that bobs up and down when you swallow. Oh, that, I said, not wanting to make his day any more difficult. I mean, I didn't want to deny him the pleasure of telling his Margie that when he got home that evening that one of the guys in the World Cup competition just happened to drop into his shop. So I said, yeah, sure, they won't let me compete, so I'll help them judge the event instead. I could see the little wheels spinning in his head. Jesus, I imagined him saying to himself, this kid has got to be something pretty hot to be a judge in the greatest bodybuilding show ever staged. He looked at me and I knew my typewriter would soon be ready for collection. Look, he said finally, the hired help is strictly for the birds these days. What say you come back in, say, 15 minutes? I'll fix your machine myself. See what I mean? The prejudging of the various Golds Classic contests had been scheduled to commence at midday. By 9:30, the fans had started arriving at the Shrine Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles. Oscar State, General Secretary of the IFBB, was already there when I came in through the stage entrance. So were a number of other people that I knew would be facing the Sisyphean task of sorting winners from among the likes of Robbie Robinson and Boyer Coe and Roy Callender and Danny Padilla, each man purportedly in his best ever shape. Joe Weider strolled in around 11 a.m. Ben was already at the theater, so I had been assured, doubtless taking care of IFBB business. I would discover later that he'd been making arrangements to have the Honorable G. Lopez Portillo, patron of the World Bodybuilding Championships to be staged in Acapulco, Mexico this year, picked up at LAX. I spied Robbie Robinson walking around 15 minutes before midday, cool as a Caribbean breeze, if you please. His big win in New York, the Night of the Champions, had been exactly what the doctor ordered. His self-confidence that had taken such a whipping months earlier at the 1977 Mr. Olympia now seemed at its shining best. How you feeling, Robbie? I asked. I'm ready to go to war, he replied, and he meant it. Tell me, my man, what are you going to do with the caddy that I understand is on the line for the World Cup guys tonight? He straightened up, chuckled, brought his right hand to his forehead. I'll tell you what, he said, I'm going to sell the darn thing and then I'll buy myself a BMW. I figure there'll still be some change left over for legitimate business after that. Does our man sound like Arnold after Joe Weider? Robbie's come a long way. I spent the next quarter of an hour or so caught up in conversation with Earl Menard, the former IFBB Mr. Universe, not to mention star of The Deep, opposite Jacqueline Bisset. Earl seemed to have his heart set on taking the over 40 Mr. America trophy home, but I couldn't help wondering why the promoters had not demanded a thorough investigation of the fellow's birth certificate. Honest, Earl looked no more than, heck, 35? He would be doing battle against another famous Mr. Universe, NABBA, by the name of Ray Routledge. And then there was Don Peters, who had appeared a couple weeks earlier at Franco Colombo's fated Mr. America, AFAB, and was impressive. At one point, Oscar State called me over to where he was sitting with Jacques Blumhardt and some other bodybuilders from Europe. What's the matter, said Oscar, who I've known for many, many years. Don't you recognize old friends from England? Before long, we were discussing such volatile IFBB matters as, yes, wait for it, the makeup or ethnic of judging panels. The 1977 Mr. Olympia, which he said I had written up in absentia. He was wrong. The placement versus point system of judging, etc. Oscar knows his stuff, and he's at least one of the more vital organs of the IFBB, but obviously that does not make him infallible, and he knows it. Roy Callender was backstage with his attractive wife. Bill Reynolds tried to interview him, but that was pretty difficult. I kept interrupting with my verbal odysseys into the past when Roy and I were friends living in London. Finally, I asked him what he planned to do with the caddy that had been advertised as part of the World Cup first prize. Roy just happens to be the most diffident man in all of bodybuilding. He was not always that way. He used to be as much a pain in the neck as yours truly. Okay, so now I admit it. All of a sudden, the guy breaks down and cries in public, hugs people on stage after they wiped him out. What are you going to do with the caddy, I asked, over Bill's, what do you do for your pecs? Ah, said my Caribbean brother, smiling as only a son of Barbados can smile. I was hoping you'd ask that. If I win tonight, I'll keep the money and you can have the car. Come on, I said, I'm serious. I've already got Robbie's response to that question and now I want yours. I'm dead serious, he persisted. The car is yours if I win tonight. Had it not been for you, I never would have taken up serious bodybuilding. If I win tonight, it will be thanks to you. The car is yours. And you know what? He sounded as if he meant it. Danny Padilla, that squashed down Arnold Schwarzenegger with the winning eyes, what do you think he said when I asked him about the Cadillac? I'm going to drive that mother away. That's what he said. An aggressive son of a bitch is the giant killer. My kind of man. We were sitting in the auditorium now. Jack Neary, sure you remember him, the one who used to write funny things about competing bodybuilders with nicotine stains on their fingers. Kathy Menser, Danny Padilla's ever-loving girlfriend, and one or two other interested folk. It had been announced that for once, the contestants in all the events would be judged on stage simultaneously. No, it really was not nearly as complicated as you'd think. Sprague had thought the whole thing out in advance. Oscar State had chosen his three judging panels. He would complain later that the panels were made up mainly of Americans because invitees from Europe and elsewhere had failed to show up for one good reason or another. And they would concentrate only on their section of the massive stage. So they're judging three contests at the same time with three sets of judges. Before long, the various classes had come and gone, and we were fairly certain who would be the big winners in the Mr. Teenage and the Over 40 Mr. America contest. We'll report the blow-by-blow details on the teenage event next time around. After a while, Mike Menser joined us. First thing he said was, you won't imagine what's going on in the pump-up room. Don't be surprised if Robbie bites the dust tonight. I just took a good look at Roy Callender, and believe me, there ought to be a law against what he plans to do to Robinson, or words to that effect. But is he cut? Trust Jack Neary to try a spoke in the works. Yeah, said Mike, he's cut all right, but I've never seen such density, not even in my bathroom mirror. And that Danny, well, what can I say about him? He's just unbelievable. We would find out soon enough. The World Cup contenders started strutting their stuff for the judges. The improvement in Pete Gronkowski was astounding. Everywhere you looked, there were deep separations. His abdominals looked like tessellations on a gargoyle's belly. Square, thick, and defined. His intercostal stood out bold, complementing the fine washboard he presented for inspection. Pete weighed around 235 pounds, all of it muscle. His posing had undergone much change. He was a real pro at last. It seemed impossible that a year ago, Pete was just another fairly large guy straining under the load of bodybuilding ambition. Bill Grant would not be fazed by the big guys. You could tell he thought he had plans of his own that no one would be allowed to trip up. He was big and he was cut. His posing had never shown more confidence. Boyer Coe had improved over his New York appearance, but this writer had seen him a lot better. He would need more than he showed at the prejudging if he planned on getting past Robinson. That he knew. And if Callender was half as good as Menser seemed to think, well, Coe has never had abdominals worthy of comment, and at the Gold's Classic, he seemed determined to keep that situation unchanged. His arms, the biceps at any rate, looked fine, and his legs were their usual unbeatable selves, but then he turned around and his back appeared flat and smooth. He posed with professional ease, however. A blind fool could have seen easily that Danny was destined to have still more vengeance against Egypt's Mohamed Makawe. That is not to say Makawe was chicken feed, no, but it was clear Danny meant to grind the feisty lightweight into the floorboards. Danny had taken the World Cup seriously. He had sacrificed, had left his beautiful girlfriend missing him back home in Rochester, while he sunned himself on Venice Beach amidst the muscleheads. He had taken to pummeling his body at the Devil's Inn, which is to say at Gold's. Hey, you don't do that sort of thing unless you're in earnest about a contest. Well, there he was now on stage going through the motions that had us all wondering how the hell Frank Zane would deal with this character from Rochester. His back was thick and wide and defined. His thighs and calves matched the best in the world. When he stood relaxed, it appeared to me that there were wings on his lower legs. That's how far his calves jutted out. Danny's deltoids and arms are matchless. How a lightweight, a guy less than 5 feet 6 inches, can have packed on so much mass is a secret that perhaps only Joe Weider might be able to answer. Danny moved beautifully, and he smiled his way into the hearts of the prejudging audience. You wanted to go out there and hug the son of a bitch, if you were crazy enough to risk your reputation on a guy whose intentions had nothing whatever to do with letting his fellows get at the spoils first. It was plain Danny planned to win. When Robbie walked on, it occurred to me that before the day was through, we would see another symmetry versus mass contest, same as apparently there had been when Zane emerged triumph against the Black Prince last October. For against the massive Roy Callender, Robbie would have to depend on the same foxiness that had seen Zane clear to the finishing post at the last Olympia. Robbie was huge. His arms and deltoids reminded me of the better-known works of Frank Frazetta, massive and ripped. The thighs have long lost their hugeness. Now they seem perfect. The biceps that once seemed to flap behind him as he moved have now been tapered. They look just fine now and aesthetic. Robbie's calves are by no means as great as Boyer Coe's, but then neither are they Billy Grant's. The man's back, when he turned, had us gasping. Robbie has learned controls that seem impossible. You find yourself doubting your sanity as he goes through his lat spreads and three-quarter turns. Sometimes he stands there motionless, but right before your eyes, the traps jump and tense. The lumbar splits. Hey, all sorts of crazy things begin to happen. Let no man ever say that Robbie Robinson cannot pose. He went through a series of postures that had us wondering about Corny. Only when Robbie hits his shots, there was also an abundance of granite muscle to be seen. You could tell Robbie was confident. He actually smiled a couple times. And then it was Roy Callender's turn. I dare say Roy is as big as ever Sergio Leiva was. His back was the most incredible thing in bodybuilding today. His arms, flexed or relaxed, are unsurpassed. Damn it, if only Roy were more aggressive. If only he believed in himself enough to not be intimidated by the competition. Once or twice, Ray flexed his thighs and we saw the gullies. But most of the time, he kept his legs completely relaxed while he concentrated on displaying his upper body. When he did a side chest pose, he left his pecs completely relaxed. What lessons he might have learned had he had the opportunity to watch Robbie do the same poses. Not once did I see Roy show his intercostals during the prejudging. It's almost as if the man is determined to be wiped out by anyone with a smidgen of chutzpah. Well, the preliminary's over. Oscar Stay called the World Cup contenders back for further scrutiny by the judging panel. It was clear that at that point, Grant's ambitions were in for a rude surprise. Together with McAway and Coe, he was destined to end up tails. The real battle would be fought by Robinson, Callender, Padilla, and yes, Pete Grimkowski. By the way, what a really nice fellow Grim has turned out to be. There was a time when many of us wouldn't go near him. He seemed to be ready to devour human meat, cooked or otherwise. But wonderful to report, the guy really is a quite affable under all that muscle. Ditto Kent Keen. One time I actually begged Ken Sprague to dump him from his reception desk. Obnoxious was the word I think I used to describe him. Well, I was wrong again. Kent is really a nice chappy once you get past the weird sense of humor. Believe me, Jack. But I better quit this sort of talk, otherwise I might be in danger of losing my own image. The trouble with Pete Grimkowski is his posing. He seems to shrink when he hits a shot. Those massive deltoids that bump you right in the retina when he's standing relaxed, well, they seem to disappear when Pete tenses up a lat spread or a double bicep pose. His back could do with much specialized intention. But Pete is definitely on his way. If he continues to improve at the present rate, we could see him next year weighing 240 pounds at under 6 feet and ripped. Oh, my God. So the prejudging ended, and still we were not certain who would drive the caddy home. Callender had more muscle than anyone in the event, than anyone this writer has ever seen. But Robbie obviously had a very special fight plan. That you could tell. Danny Padilla was without a flaw. He was tanned, beautifully put together, and unafraid. We would have to wait till the evening's performance. One killed the next 3 or 4 hours talking shop with Jack Neary, enjoying his tales of life as a Calgary newspaper man. We treated him to some clam chowder, exposed him to some first-class literature, and then it was time to head for the theater. The greatest bodybuilding contest in history was late getting underway. John Barzaccini came on at about 8:15 to let his impatient audience know that he would be the master of ceremonies for the evening, and then he apologized for the late start. I'm sorry to say we'll be a little late. There are a lot of people outside still waiting to get inside. Wouldn't it be nice if the Dodgers held up their game until fans were comfortably seated? But Barzaccini wasn't fibbing. Even as he spoke, a large crowd was trying to buy tickets for the big show. Let it be said, however, that finally the audience was not quite large enough to fill out the 6,500 or so seats at the Shrine Auditorium. Shortly before the curtains came up, I caught part of a conversation emanating from the row behind me. "Honest," the lady was saying to her friend. "I was sitting directly behind Robbie Robinson at some show or other, and I couldn't see a darn thing. I mean, really, he's so huge. I just had to touch him." So he leaned over and squeezed his delts and sort of suggested we exchange seats. He felt so good. Barzaccini's voice from the stage interrupted the promising confession. The greatest bodybuilding contest in history was about to begin. The Teenage Mr. America contest was first. We've already announced the results of this event. Check your next issue of Muscle Builder for details. Next came the over 40 Mr. America contenders. This writer has never been a fan of this event. It seems to me that 40 is no big deal age, and the people who persist in exhibiting themselves in this contest really are doing a disservice to bodybuilding. After all, Sergio Oliva is 46, Serge Nubre is at least 42, and Bill Pearl is well on his way to 50. There would be heart attacks all around if these gentlemen decided to give up the real world of competition to show off instead among the crowd of 40-year-old luminaries we saw at the Shrine Auditorium. Certainly Earl Menard and Don Peters with some serious training would be good enough for the toughest lineups the AAU can muster up. Menard looked as good as back when he took the IFBB Mr. Universe title back in 1965, or was it 1966? His bubbling personality complemented his physique, and the crowd showed their approval when he was declared the big winner. But Don Peters must have chased Earl all the way. Cliff Ford, the medium height class, and Clarence Bass, the short class winners, were second and third, respectively. The world team was now ready to clash with the U.S. side. Poor Makawe, once more he would be disgraced by Danny Padilla. Gone were the striations for which the Egyptian had become particularly famous. He seemed to have lost some of his fire, too. He was bigger than he'd ever been before, but the price he paid was far too high. He must have known as he posed that his fate was already sealed. Danny Padilla brought the house down. Carlos Rodriguez had improved over his fantastic showing a couple weeks earlier when he took the AFAB Mr. USA title, but he would taste disappointment on this night. Peter Stock was heavily muscled and well-defined. Alos Peck was impressive, as was Renato Bertagna. But Darcy Beckles, my buddy from Barbados, was a complete flop. He had been brought over to California to train for the event. What happened will require more space than is available here. Suffice it to say that Darcy had never looked worse. His posing was lifeless. He was smooth and small. He forgot to strike his best poses. Darcy was a loser from start to finish, and that's not all. Paul Grant appeared untrained. Even though one had lived in England for half a lifetime, this was my first opportunity to see Grant in action. His pictures in Muscle Builder, taken at a time when he lived in Santa Monica, had led me to expect great things of him. I was disappointed. On the other hand, the American team was devastating. There was Mike Mentzer and his brother Ray, Ron Tufel too. The three could also have taken on Mars and Saturn, never mind the world. Mike's posing has improved beyond the horizons of my vocabulary. What a cop-out for a writer that line seems to be. He was big and he was confident. His definition was never better, and the improvement in his back had the crowd hollering for more. Ray Mentzer, though slightly behind Big Brother, was at his best. He's taken to duplicating some of Mike's incredible leg poses, which provided ample excuse for the pandemonium at the Shrine Auditorium. Give Ray some more time, Mike, and then watch out. I am not a Ron Tufel fan. Change that, I was not a fan until his appearance at the Gold's Classic. I'd always thought Ron's body, though muscular and dense, was somewhat boxy, too square for my personal taste. But on the other Saturday's showing, I can say competitors in the AAU Mr. America and the coming IFBB events had better be in pretty miraculous shape if they plan on taking on Tufel. He has mastered the art of showing what he has to his best advantage. No mean feat. Think of Roy Callender, who has so much but cannot display it. Apart from his waist, which I think is a little wide, if muscular, Ron's body is flawless. He poses with confidence and intelligence. He is big and will go very far indeed, as far as the Mr. Olympia, no doubt. The results of the team contest sounded deja vu. For the time the MC came to the matter of announcements, it was obvious Beckles and his colleagues had blown the whole thing. The U.S. was in, the world was out. Menser took his class, as did Danny Padilla and Ron Tufel. Poor McAway had the awful experience of placing last. There would be further bad medicine for my double. Pete Gronkowski started the World Cup event. He posed with great finesse, even though the little flaws mentioned earlier were still in existence. He was followed by Padilla and McAway. Then it was Bill Grant and Boyer Coe. And then the MC announced Robbie Robinson. There had been a time when it seemed Robbie's legend superseded the reality of the man. No matter how great he appeared on stage, it seemed the fans felt he did not quite match up to the publicity. Well, this time Robbie came on looking exactly like a black prince ought to look. He was dynamite, and he exploded on the posing platform like something straight out of the bowels of hell. He was fantastic. He hit his side chest shot, raised the rib cage high, and then just as you thought he was about to move into another position, he brought pressure to bear on the delts, the pecs, the abdominals. Everywhere you looked, there were gullies and holes and lumps and mounds. Robbie, Robbie, Robbie. The crowd had already caught the spirit. Pose after pose brought Robbie Robinson closer to the advertised Cadillac. Doubtless his own line was echoing in his head. "They're going to look at me and know I mean business," he had said to me earlier. Yes, Robbie, we looked and we knew. But there was still Roy Callender waiting in the wings. A tremendous whoop rose from the near-packed auditorium as he approached the posing rostrum. What is left to say about this monster who was not above breaking down on stage at his best moments? He seemed to have everything you'd expect a Mr. Olympia winner to produce. But Roy, I cannot say it often enough, is like a kid with a Sherman tank. He has yet to learn what to do with that phenomenal back. He wastes those amazing arms and deltoids, hides his intercostals and abdominals, forgets his thighs. And damn it, Roy, what the hell happened to your contest-clinching aggressiveness? Maybe Mrs. Callender should feed her monster more red meat, and the bloodier the better. That would do it. Well, Oscar brought them back on stage after each had treated us to their individual routines. At last, it was time for Danny, Robbie, and Callender to go to work, the rest having been rightly been set aside. Here was action for men only. The boys had their little day. This had to be one of the most exciting post-downs ever. Robbie was obviously decided he was not going to trade mass shots with the gargantuan Callender. So just as Roy would get into a front double bicep pose from the front, Robbie would hit a side chest pose, intercostals, ripped thighs, striated pecs and all. Roy would crank up a lat spread and immediately Robbie would swing into a three-quarter back pose. It went on that way seemingly for 5 minutes, the crowd cheering them on with bleeding cries. Then Roy decided to give Robbie a last-minute run for his money and Cadillac. He did his darndest to emulate every Robbie pose. Robbie swung into biceps pose and Roy was there in a similar posture. A back shot for Robbie and wham, there was Roy duplicating it. Maybe coming off best. So Robbie speeded up the action. Now his greater stage presence, his experience began to take him closer and closer to all-out victory. Callender had decided to come out too late. You knew finally it would be Robbie Robinson way one more time, even by a nose. I had them placed this way. Robbie first, Roy Callender second, Danny third, Gronkowski fourth. It was not the way the judges saw it. Callender had to take third place to the flawless Padilla. Grimm seemed happy with his fourth spot. Meanwhile, Billy Grant was fuming. He found it most difficult to accept defeat at the hands of Boyer Coe. And I must say there were many who thought Grant should have beaten Coe. For my part, I felt Boyer was not at his best. He was smooth. But then I was not a judge. Poor McAway again had to be satisfied with the last spot. It remains to be said that the vaunted greatest contest ever fell short of the mark. Save for the excitement generated by the Callender Robinson pose down, the contest was hardly different from any other one that's been seen here. There was far more fire in the first Gold's Classic. But then a promoter, Ken Sprague, can hardly be blamed for that. A number of competitors who promised to be on hand later had second thoughts. The world team was pitifully out of shape. and the music supplied by the Streetcar Trio, although fabulous when taken on its own, distracted from the bodybuilders' performances on stage. We heard too little of the orchestra that had been rebooked on the strength of its last performance. According to the announcer, Robbie would collect $7,000 and a car. Danny had earned his $5,000, and Callender was to receive $3,000. At the time of the writing, Robbie still has not turned up in Caddy or BMW. Maybe later. It remains to be said that some of Mr. Baroccini's announcements came out a little garbled. One wasn't certain whether it was said that Ben Weider, the president of the IPB, was also something politically big in Mexico. It might have been better had Ben been properly brought on and then left to introduce the Honorable G. Lopez Portillo, sports minister of Mexico. We were highly honored that this gentleman could attend the show with his charming wife, but he felt he should have been given better treatment. One did not get around to sampling the 7-foot cake that Sprague ordered, especially for the after contest bash. I had other more palatable things waiting to be eaten at home. In the end, the day was not a total loss. All right. And then they've got the scores here. So Robbie in the first round, standing relaxed, scored 98, almost perfect. Roy Callender was 93. Danny was 92. And Pete Rimkowski was 90. So pretty close. The second round, the mandatory poses, Robbie got 99. Roy Callender got 94. Danny got 93. Pete Rimkowski got an 87. And then the next round is the posing round. And Robbie also scored the highest, 296. Roy Callender was 283. Danny, 280. Pete Rimkowski, 265. And then the judges' totals, Robbie had... Oh, this is the totals from each judge. And then the pose down. Now, this is interesting. This is where Danny beat Roy. This is the placement system. So all the judges dropped the point system, and this was the pose down, and they placed them one through third. So it was only the top three, as Rick said, Robbie, Roy, and Danny Padilla. So Robbie got, let's see, six first place votes and one third. Roy Callender got only one first place vote. And he got 2 second place votes and 4 third place votes. And then Danny did not get any first place votes, but he got, let's see, 4 second place votes and 5 second place votes and 2 third place votes. So Danny got a 16, Roy got a 17, and Robbie got 9. So Robbie was obviously first. And then Danny squeezed ahead of Roy by 1 point to get second place. All right. All right, guys. Well, that is the two big shows in 1978, the two big professional competitions that took place in 1978 besides Mr. Olympia. And I said, this was the year that professional bodybuilding started. So it was Wayne D'Amelia and Ken Sprague who were starting professional bodybuilding in addition to the Mr. Olympia. So that takes us to the early roots of our sport when pro bodybuilding really started. It was that long ago, 1978. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed those blasts from the past, the articles by Rick Wayne and the articles by Muscle Digest, as well as Muscle Mag International. We will be back next week with another show. Until then, enjoy your springtime weather. Have some great workouts. Stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.